and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Budget 2023 was retabled today, and at 386.14 billion ringgit, it is the largest budget on record. It is 16% bigger than the budget that was tabled last October. Healthcare received the second biggest allocation of the federal budget, 36.3 billion ringgit. That's a slight increase from what was allocated in the budget tabled last year. But will it be enough to address the many issues affecting Malaysia's public healthcare system? Joining me now is Azrul Muhammad Khalib. He is the Chief Executive of the Gallen Centre for Health and Social Policy, which is a healthcare policy research and advocacy outfit. Azrul, thank you for joining me tonight. What are your initial reactions to Budget 2023 when it comes to issues regarding healthcare?
Well, you know,
Melissa, it's been a very bit of a roller coaster listening to the finance minister speak of the budget, and we see it as a very optimistic tone towards tackling some of the teething problems we've been talking about, not just the past few months, but actually a few years. Things like recruiting and retaining healthcare workers, modernizing aging infrastructure, decongesting public health facilities, which we've heard quite a lot about in the past month, and addressing emerging public health threats such as vape and e-cigarettes. However, it must be said, though, it did fall short on some issues such as
care financing.
Okay. Can we touch on the fact, so the excise duties that's been making the headlines since that portion of the budget was announced, the government planning to impose excise duties on e-cigarettes or vape liquids, anything containing liquids or gels containing nicotine. What do you make of this? This is part of the the tobacco control bills, the Control of Tobacco Product and Smoking Bill. Is that where you see it coming from?
Well, you know, this was one of the more exciting parts of the budget for health. It was quite heartening to hear the government confirm its commitment to the generation endgame objectives for tobacco and vape, which is a brought over from the previous administration. And the fact that it has announced the earmarking for health of half of the future revenue to be collected from the regulation and taxation of e-cigarettes and vape containing nicotine is certainly welcome. You know, of course, the Gallen Centre has been a strong advocate of earmarking such revenues from tobacco and alcohol excise duties for the purposes of health. However, one thing we did note that this proposal, which was shared today, does not seem to include vape without nicotine. Now, the Malaysian vape industry, as was presented earlier, is estimated to be worth more than 2 billion ringgit, and it's largely made up of actually no nicotine vape. So regulating and taxing only nicotine vape and e-cigarettes will actually produce less than what the government expects. We say that all vape and e-cigarettes products should be taxed, regardless whether they are with nicotine or without. So we also come to the question of when will the revised version of the Tobacco and Smoking Control Bill, which was worked on by the Parliamentary Select Committee last year, be tabled. Because we hope that with this declared intent to tax vape, it will be followed by the passing of this very important legislature. Obviously, it is quite overdue.
Azrul, do you think that the generational endgame provision will be included in the final tobacco bill?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, at the end of the day, that is basically what we're aiming for us to close the gate onto new persons over the age of 18, especially to deal with underage smoking and vaping. But the reality is it all goes back down to where the support is in the Dewan Rakyat for that kind of legislation. So we're hoping that the bill that is submitted to the floor will include the GG, but the consideration may be different from the Prime Minister or the government's perspective. So we'll see what happens when the bill finally makes it to the Dewan Rakyat.
There was also a portion that talked about decongesting some of the hospitals, patients be redirected to other health facilities. What do you make of that? Are you concerned that there could be unintended consequences of having, of redirecting patients to other hospitals like university hospitals, army hospitals, and I believe the text also mentioned private hospitals.
Well, you know, it's very hard to see how that can happen at the moment, especially with regards to how a previous arrangement that was made during the COVID MCO, the period, the COVID crisis, where basically the government was basically paying for the services of the patients that were being decanted to the private sector. So the problem right now is really with regards to the allocation. You mentioned at the start of the program about it being 36.3 billion now. As you rightly pointed out, it is slightly a greater commitment to health compared to the previous budget proposed by the Islamic Sabri administration at 36.1 billion. And, you know, it's actually 2.2% of the GDP if we were to look at it that way. So obviously, this is an increase, definitely the largest increase in the Ministry of Health's budget in the past 5 years at 12%, and it's currently at 9.4% of the total budget, or 388.1 billion. But the reality is that it's probably not going to be enough to be able to shuttle or decant some of those patients to the private sector, because at the end of the day, the private sector is not going to do it for free. They have to be paid. But what I'm actually excited about, and this is going back to the congestion problem, is this new initiative that the government is considering, which is the Scheme Pubatan Madani, or the Madani Medical Scheme, which is potentially a game changer. You know, we've seen the proven public-private partnership models from Selangor and Protect Health. So think about it, you know, if we provide those who qualify to be enrolled in the scheme, particularly those from lower-income households with subsidised access to private general practitioners or GP clinics at a national level, this scheme could significantly relieve the pressure and burden on the congested emergency departments at public hospitals across the country. So I'm looking forward to seeing that rolled out.
Azrul, so you said it's based on the Selangor model that was rolled out. What do you know about it? How does it work? Can you tell us anything about it?
Well, basically, you know, it's like whenever you are employed at a company or some other, right? So you're told that you have a panel of doctors or clinics that you can go to as part of your coverage under your employment. So you can just go there and you don't have to pay anything. And basically, this is what it is for this particular scheme. So imagine that those who are enrolled into the scheme, they have a card that they can then use and go to a GP clinic, get the kind of treatment and care that they would usually go to an emergency department in a public hospital for, and then they get medication and they go. So the consultation and medication is going to be covered under the scheme and they pay nothing at the door. So this alone is going to be quite an interesting experiment to see whether or not it can actually move people away from depending on emergency departments for what is relatively non-emergency care to a GP clinic.
Right. So the congestion at emergency and trauma departments, that's just one of the many symptoms of a healthcare system in crisis, Azrul, and this budget is coming on the back of that. Yes, slightly increased, but I'm just wondering, what does this increased budget solve? What does expanded funding solve versus what doesn't it solve? I know that the MMA president has previously said that there are issues that can be resolved not having to wait for an increased allocation, a budget allocation. What do you think, Azrul? Are there issues that can be solved without having to depend on an increase in the budget for health?
Well, definitely there's a lot of low-hanging fruit there. And I think the MMA president was referring to the criteria that's used to evaluate the eligibility of a person to be able to be a permanent contract holder as opposed to, a permanent position as opposed to a contract holder. Now, these things don't cost any money, and it's really about being transparent and open about how those are being selected for permanent positions. But the unfortunate reality is that, as been mentioned time and again, and
is that we have underinvested in our healthcare. And so a lot of what we're doing right now is really catching up. You might notice from the budget breakdown, there's actually a massive increase in investment amounting to hundreds of millions of ringgit in critical infrastructure. And this actually represents a strong and clear recognition that the repair, maintenance, upgrading of existing and aging structures and facilities, which actually includes things like modernization and digitalization of health information systems, is actually long overdue. So what this will actually do is that it will potentially translate to improved efficiency, shorter patient waiting times, which is very important, yeah, and better delivery of health care services. Now, people don't know this, but it has been pointed out. The first time I heard it was from Dr. Zhou, one of our previous health ministers, who said that, you know, out of Malaysia's more than 156 public hospitals, 45 are over 100 years old. So, you know, we definitely are urgently needing an upgrade on many of our different services, and we need to repair and definitely need to deal with some aging structure. So, unfortunately, you can't run away from the fact that you have to spend, you have to invest more money to address some of these teething problems.
Fascinating fact. Thank you for sharing that with us. I didn't know that. As well, in the few minutes that we have left, I do want to give some time to the fact that there was a town hall on Wednesday with government doctors, with the health minister. What did you take away from that town hall? I understand you didn't attend, but, you know, having read about it or talked to people who attended, what were some of your takeaways about the trajectory of where the health ministry is heading?
Well, you know, for one thing, it's very important to realize that we are in a sort of leaky bucket situation. You know, there's actually a bucket where there's water coming in from the top and there's water that's coming out from holes in the bottom. And over the past year or so, these holes at the bottom have gotten bigger. There are actually more people leaving the health service than ever before. If you look at it, it's actually even 1,000% more compared to in previous years. So when you look at it today, that town hall was very important to have because it needs to, the government needs to demonstrate a commitment to addressing the healthcare worker shortage crisis. And we heard this allocation of $3 billion for new permanent and contract positions, which include, I think, around 1,500 medical officers, dental and pharmacy officers. So this is great. And we hope that this includes nurses, allied health workers and supporting staff who are critical to the health system. Now, that town hall is also very important because the government clearly, from the findings of that town hall, the government must also demonstrate commitment to not only recruit new personnel, but fund the promotion of existing staff and increase salaries to support retention of skilled healthcare workers today. Because I can tell you, Melissa, we are losing our skilled doctors, nurses to other countries like Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, the UK. And one of the reasons why we're losing that is not just because we're not paying them enough, but also poor workplace conditions. So there's a lot that needs to be addressed, and certainly the town hall was a positive step forward towards the government being able to address that.
Azra, thank you so much for speaking with me. That was Azra Muhammad Khalib, Chief Executive of the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy. We're going to take a very quick break here and consider this. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm Melissa Idris. You're watching Consider This. Let's continue our conversation about the retabled budget 2023. It's the largest budget on record at 386 billion ringgit. But is it a budget that will work for everyone? Is it a gender-responsive budget? Now, gender-responsive budgets simply means applying a gender lens when designing a budget, through assessing the needs of men and women and girls and boys and putting that through the norms and roles often associated with them. So joining us on the show now to discuss if this retabled budget 2023 showed any gender-responsive changes, we have Lisa Fernandez. She's an advocate Advocacy and Operations Manager at Engenda Consultancy, which is part of the Engenda Budget Group. Lisa, thank you for joining on the show today. Now, what were your initial reactions to this new budget 2023? Was this a gender-responsive budget?
Hi, Melissa. Thank you. I think it's great that you've just sort of quickly established GRB, but I feel like I just want to elaborate a little bit more and reiterate that, you know, it's not a budget just for women, and it's not just about allocations concerning women-related issues, and it's also not about dividing the budget equally for men and women. It really is an inclusive budget, like you mentioned. And using this approach, it's really much more holistic and accurate in terms of understanding different situations among these different groups, their experiences, their needs, and also the potential of these different groups of women and men. The other thing is really about how it takes an intersectional lens as well. It's not just gender alone, but really we're looking at education, age, whether you have a disability or not, are you what your education level is, and your socioeconomic background. So that there are a lot of different considerations, and really this is just how it is a budget, how it ensures that budgets and programs really benefit everyone. So is it a gender responsive budget? In some areas, we did see gender-responsive measures. So, for example, there were incentives for women to return to the workforce after giving birth, with Perkeso amending its act to allow for grants of up to 80% of insured salary. But I think there is a lot more detail that we need to see there to properly understand what that's going to entail. The attention to accessibility of childcare. So there was the creation of guidelines for childcare centres and offices, including high-rise offices, tax incentives and allowances for the cost of creating childcare facilities in the office. Also programmes for formalising of existing unregistered childcare centres, which is important, as well as childcare fee subsidies. And this would be accessible to those with a household income of less than 7,000 ringgit. The only issue here, and I think this is something we will always bring up, is it's not clear how women in the informal sector will benefit from this, and I can perhaps elaborate on that a bit more later. I think the other thing I just want to mention is that, having said that, the language of the budget was gender neutral, it was gender blind, and it seemed like these things were piecemeal, and it didn't demonstrate that there was a reflection on root causes of, you know, certain inequalities, or it didn't take into account gender dimensions throughout. And so I think that's where, you know, there's a lot more work to be done in ensuring that GRB is implemented and gender considerations are taken in from the very beginning.
That's interesting. You mentioned that it was gender blind. What did you hope to see so that it was more gender sensitive, gender responsive?
Right. So continuing from, you know, the tax incentives on childcare, right? This is great. But the only thing is, you know, what is it doing to help those in the informal sector who are not eligible? So and if you have a gender lens on this and you take a gender responsive approach, you would realize that those who comprise majority of the informal sector are women, and especially women in the B14. Category. And so their income doesn't meet the taxable threshold, meaning they cannot claim it. And so in that sense, that's why we always want to see allocations and efforts towards community-based childcare, because really it's those in the informal sector, women, families that need it the most. Another thing is, of course, women who engage in unpaid care work, they are also not recognized as part of the formal labor force. And so then how are they, you know, benefiting as well? Besides that, you know, I think through and through, we'll always talk about gender-based violence and tackling gender-based violence. So there was mention of allocation for D11, but we don't know how much that is. You know, previously it was more specific, but we really want to see creation of more government shelters for survivors of GBV, gender sensitivity training for frontliners. And why that training is especially urgent right now is that there have been three public incidents of dress code policing this year alone. So there's a lot there that needs to be done. And just one other thing is, We are wondering what happened to allocations in the first iteration of Budget 2023, where there were subsidies for mammograms. It talked about allocations relating to the newly implemented Anti-Sexual Harassment Act, after it was tabled, the program Latihan Khas for Kepimpinan Wanita, and also allocation for the gender focal teams that have been recently set up.
Right, that's a good point, because the gender focal teams was something that I thought would be great, you know, having that in every department, you know, government departments, government agencies, that could help expand the education around gender-responsive budgeting. Lisa, can you talk to me a little bit about that, about the tracking and the monitoring of some of these initiatives or the allocations, ensuring that it actually does have an impact? So I guess impact assessment for these allocations. How can Malaysia better improve in that respect?
Yes, so monitoring and impact assessments, this is actually an aspect that is most neglected, not only here in Malaysia, but really everywhere. Monitoring is so important because it's about transparency, checks and balance. But you must monitor throughout, right, to ensure that what you set out to do and set out to achieve, by when and for whom, that, you know, you have reached that sort of desired outcome. And if not, then you can ascertain why and you can dig deeper. And I think for, you know, just to give an example, like with the D11 measure or allocation, in budget 2022, 13 million ringgit was allocated, and this was to hire an additional 100 officers in the unit. But we don't know what happened. You know, there's no public, you know, monitoring evaluation or you know, any transparent monitoring and evaluation system for us to rely on. So we actually don't know what happened there, and we don't know whether M&E was conducted as well, you know, after the training was done. And also, I think that, you know, while yes, M&E is crucial standalone, it is especially central to GRB. And not just any M&E, but if you want to ensure gender-sensitive outcomes, you need to make sure that you have gender-sensitive monitoring and evaluation in place.
Right.
It's participatory. It involves women and men, children's voices, marginalized groups' voices, and right. Also it's something you conduct really throughout the cycle of the budget,
but,
right?
But that tracking and that monitoring leads to having data. And can you talk a little bit about why it's so important that we have gender disaggregated data, particularly in, you know, ensuring that allocations go to the right measures?
Yes. So thanks for bringing up the data aspect, because that is especially central as well, and it's really from the get go when you are looking to benefit a certain group, you need to know everything. And it's not just about, you know, collecting quantitative data, which we tend to do a lot of. And in that involves sex disaggregated data, right? So like, for example, how many boys and girls are in school? How many of them have a disability? How many of them are in rural areas or from, you know, the B40 group? This already warrants different interventions based on this data alone. But then, what happens when you don't capture, you know, gender data, which really deep dives into understanding the lived realities of our population? It's like, it's basically asking certain questions like, you know, what is the current situation of this group? What are their needs and priorities? What are the specific areas of inequality that need to be addressed here? And so what gender data does is really adequately reflect the differences and inequalities and needs. And it also takes into account stereotypes and, you know, social and cultural factors that may induce a gender bias in data. And when we have gender data, it only means that we will have better targeted interventions, better allocation of resources. I think I'll stop there, yeah.
Oh, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight. Thank you for your time. That was Lisa Fernandez from Engenda Consultancy and the Gender Budget Group wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching and good night.